Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sun Up with the Colorado Sun. It's Wednesday, August 18th. The chaotic end to the 20-year war is being felt here in Colorado. The state is home to thousands of soldiers and airmen, and as of April, 40 troops from Colorado had been killed in Afghanistan. Today, we hear from local veteran and Democratic State Representative David Ortiz. Before we begin, we'd like to thank our sponsors at Rocky Mountain Immigrant Advocacy Network. Rocky Mountain Immigrant Advocacy Network fights for justice by providing free immigration legal services to individuals, children, and families in Colorado. Join them on Thursday, August 19th for their annual Immigrant Liberty Awards, celebrating immigrants and advocates in our community. The event is virtual and free to attend. Register at rmian.org/ILA. But before we begin, let's go back in time with some Colorado history, adapted from historian Derek R. Everett's book, Colorado Day by Day. Today, we take you back to August 18, 1989, when the Fort St. Vrain power station shut down. Conceived of in 1965, the nuclear power plant went online in 1976 and was plagued by issues and repairs for most of its life. Leaks, small fires, and other woes kept the station from meeting its potential, and other nuclear disasters of Three Mile Island and Chernobyl resulted in the public's support for nuclear power to decline. 4 years later, the power plant would reopen, this time using natural gas. Now our feature story. As the Taliban takes control of Afghanistan after President Joe Biden ordered the U.S. military withdrawal from the country, the chaotic end to the 20-year war is being felt close to home. Colorado is home to thousands of soldiers and airmen, many of whom were deployed to the South Asian country in the past two decades. As of April, nearly 2,500 American troops were killed in Afghanistan, including 40 from Colorado and 95 who were stationed at Fort Carson. There are mixed feelings among those who fought for freedom and now are learning of the Taliban rule. Colorado Sun political reporter Jesse Paul interviewed local veterans, including Democratic State Representative David Ortiz, who crash-landed in eastern Afghanistan in June 2012.
So, Representative, why don't we just start with some background about, you know, your time in the military, what branch you served in, what battalion, and when you deployed over to Afghanistan?
Yeah, absolutely. So I joined in 2008, January of 2008 is when I joined. Went through basic at Fort Jackson, then went through Warrant Officer Candidate School at Fort Rucker in Alabama, went through flight school there. Got to my first duty station, which was Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I was with the 82nd Combat Aviation Brigade, specifically with Alpha Troop 117 Cavalry. So, you know, got there and we deployed in September of 11. Our deployment was supposed to last until September of 12, and we deployed to FOB Salerno, which is in Khost Province, Afghanistan.
And I know your deployment, you know, kind of ended here in tragedy. So can you tell us a little bit about what happened while you were in Afghanistan?
Yeah, so I was with my unit at FOB Salerno. We flew Kiowa Warriors. OH-58D is the designator. It's a combat recon scout mission. It was a day like any other day, that, like, as these stories go. We were tasked with trying to see if rumors of a Dishka, which is a Russian high-powered machine gun, equivalent kind of to the 50 cal. We got rumors that the Taliban were putting a Dishka nest at one end of the runways, so we were tasked to try and look for it. We couldn't find any signs that was true. We did a test fire in the area just to let them know that we were looking for them just in case they were in the area. And then started heading back to the base for rearm and refuel. And we got indication that our engine started having problems. So we started, we moved to an autorotative profile to initiate emergency landing just in case things went from bad to worse. And they did. The engine exploded. So we had to initiate an autorotation, which is an emergency landing. My memory cuts out at about 20 feet from the ground. And I woke up 3 to 5 minutes later. Dust thick in the air, just feeling hot, covered in metal. And I say 3 to 5 minutes later because we always fly in teams of two, and the sister ship was in the process of landing to check for signs of life. The co-pilot got out. The pilot in command picked up to pull security single pilot. The co-pilot then started ripping the metal from out off of me. He asked, "Oh, still alive?" He yelled at me, "Ortiz, are you still alive?" And I was like, "Yeah, get me the hell out of here." So he started ripping the metal from on top of me. And rendering first aid, he grabbed a bunch of gauze from his first aid kit, and I had I had my helmet got ripped off, lacerations on the top of my skull, fractured left cheekbone. I had a cut in the bottom of my chin to where some of the stuff started coming out of the bottom of my mouth. So he grabbed a bunch of gauze to push everything back in and was like, here, hold this. I had a collapsed right lung, broken ribs, obviously broken vertebrae with spinal cord damage. And I know that I had spinal cord damage because I looked down at my feet and my feet were 90 degrees perpendicular to my tib and fib bone and I couldn't feel pain. So I knew I was in bad shape. My focus was just on trying to stay alive. The medevac got there within 3 to 5 minutes to free me from the rest of the wreckage and render first aid. And my memory cuts out. I became unconscious on the way to, back to the, you know, the hospital at FOB Salerno, where they stabilized me, moved me on to Bagram. And then from Bagram, I went to Landstuhl, and Landstuhl was where the first place that I woke up and realized that it wasn't a dream. Then I went to Walter Reed, did emergent care at Walter Reed. And the military doesn't have anything organic for brain and spinal cord injuries, so they farm you out to VAs. I went to San Antonio, though, because my lower limbs were so damaged that they weren't sure if they could save them or if they were going to have to amputate. So that's why I was at Fort Sam Houston. They were able to save my lower limbs, but the spinal cord injury unit at the VA that I was at was underfunded, and it was pathetic. It was the worst 6 months of my life. And the main care physician himself was like, you don't belong here. You need to get yourself to one of these hospitals on this list I'm about to give you. Craig Hospital was one of those three. I did my homework and chose to come here. It was a fight, though. The leadership that I had at the time were getting in the way of me coming to Craig Hospital. I went to the media and my elected leaders, and 2 months later, the leadership was gone and replaced, and a month later, I was at Craig Hospital, and that changed my life.
Were there people who were aboard that helicopter with you who didn't survive the crash?
It's an attack recon scout helicopter, so it's only a two-seater, the pilot in command and myself. I was the co-pilot that day. And he did survive. He did end up being a left leg below the knee amputee. And he did continue to fly for the Army.
So you really gave a lot for your country during your deployment.
I would say yes.
Talk to me a little bit about your journey into politics. You know, now you're a state representative at the Capitol, you're influencing policy. How exactly did you get there?
I mean, I think the seed got planted. My first job after graduating college was resettling evacuees after Hurricane Katrina. And I just saw so many systemic failures that I realized policy was kind of the way to try and solve that. The next job I got after that was working for the mayor's office for the city of Houston. So that was kind of a taste of it. But ironically, I got bored of sitting behind a desk. So that's what brought me to serving my country in a more intense way and flying helicopters to the Army. I got a taste of it again when leadership started getting in my way of my care that I know that I'd earned and that I needed. And I turned to elected leaders and to the media to be able to help me get the care that I needed to hold my leadership accountable. And so once I was medically retired here in Colorado in 2015, my battalion commander was like, hey, you've got a big mouth and you're kind of outgoing. There's a veterans group that advocates and lobbies for veterans at the state capitol. You should do some work with them. So I started off as an intern in 15 and 16, working in Denver to advocate for veterans, and was lead lobbyist in 2017, got some great bills passed around mental health care and also higher education reform for veterans. Then I started focusing more on my nonprofit work in 18. But during one of my legislative forums that I hosted around mental health, there was a lot of state and federal electeds that were there at that event. We had over 70 veteran and non-veteran leaders there. Senator Pedersen was one of them. And she comes up to me and she's like, hey, have you ever considered running for office? And I really enjoyed the work I was doing. So I told her not really and no. And she was like, hold on, before you make a decision, talk to your community and your family and the important people in my life. And Senator Pedersen does not take no for an answer. So eventually I said yes, and here I am.
And that's Senator Brittany Pedersen from Lakewood that you're mentioning. Can you talk to me a little bit about, you know, your feelings in recent days about what's happening in Afghanistan? I know that we've talked to a lot of veterans in Colorado who have just mixed feelings about what they're watching. As somebody who gave a lot for their country in Afghanistan, I'm kind of wondering what your perspective is over what's happened in the last week and several months.
I mean, over the several months, I was optimistic. We've been there for 20 years. I believe that we had done what we needed to do to train the Afghan National Army. And I believed that leadership wouldn't be making this decision unless we could leave Afghanistan a stable country that could fight against the Taliban. But clearly that was not the case. And when that became extremely apparent, instead of demonstrating true leadership and making adjustments, I feel like this administration stubbornly stuck to their decision and to talking points and to political campaign promises more than the reality on the ground. which has been heartbreaking and extremely frustrating and disappointing. It's been disgusting for me to see, quite frankly. And I'm saying this as a Democrat. Like, don't get me wrong. I believe in the platform and in the party and what we stand for. And I know Biden is a much better president than Trump is. But this is a mistake, and he needs to own this mistake and quit making excuses.
So it sounds like when you heard that the Biden administration was planning to pull out of Afghanistan, that you were pretty hopeful that things would go okay.
Yeah, I mean, these individuals that get elected and then also that get appointed to these positions, we have an expression in the military, that's higher than my pay grade. You trust that they're worth the pay that they earn, right? That they have the experience and can offer the president and the administration valid counsel on what to do. Well, if the administration isn't willing to listen to it or act on it, that's something else entirely, isn't it?
So I know a lot of veterans in Colorado who served in Afghanistan knew Afghans who, you know, helped out and worked as translators or helped them navigate different communities. I was wondering if you had any experience with Afghan nationals and kind of what your feeling is now, knowing that some of those folks are being left behind.
Yeah, I mean, my experience, since I was an aviator, my experience was mostly with those that were allowed on the base to work or to serve alongside us. And I am concerned about them. My heart breaks for them. I mean, we left them high and dry. Think about this. Imagine freeing yourself from the Russians only to be left by your quote unquote ally. And then an extremist faction of your society starts taking over and implements this brutal regime that does not allow women and girls to work or go to school or to be outside without a male escort, that implements brutal punishments of burying you into the sand up to your neck and throwing stones at you, whipping you, murdering you, cutting your head off. So imagine the trauma you have from that years under Taliban rule, and then you are freed from that. And all of a sudden, overnight, literally in the cover of darkness, we left Bagram Airfield, that your allies leave you, the ones that were providing logistical support, making sure that you're fed, making sure that your equipment, like your vehicles and your aircraft are maintained, and they abandon you overnight. What do you think that would do to you? I'm not surprised that the will to fight was melted away when they felt all but abandoned by us. So my heart breaks for the Afghani people. It especially breaks for the women and girls that are going to have to live under this oppressive regime. And if anybody is believing what this Taliban regime is saying about they're going to be a softer, gentler Taliban, they're more naive or ignorant or stupid or all three than they know they are.
Some of the veterans that I've spoken to have essentially said that they always thought that the war was going to end this way, that it was going to end poorly, and that the Afghan army wouldn't be able to, you know, keep the Taliban at bay. I wonder if you felt that way or you feel that way.
I'm not surprised. I'll be honest, like, I'm not surprised based on how we pulled out that things turned out the way that they did. That being said, I respect my brother and sister veterans' opinions, but, and I'll say this about myself too, I'm no national security expert, neither are they. But the example that I look to is we have had troops in Japan and in Germany since World War II. And they are still there, way more than the few thousand that we had in Afghanistan that was stabilizing Afghanistan. We have way more troops in South Korea that are still there since the Korean War. So I don't buy it, quite honestly, whether it's a veteran or a civilian saying it, I don't buy it that it had to end this way or that we had to leave. For what? For an extremist terrorist organization to take over an entire state? No, we're less safe as a nation and as a world because of this. Mark my words, guaranteed.
So I know one of the other things that some of the veterans have been saying to me is that they're kind of questioning the sacrifice that they made when they went to Afghanistan and the things they saw and the things they experienced. You obviously gave up, you know, a lot more than just kind of emotional pain. This is something that you're going to have to deal with for the rest of your life. I wonder if you're looking back at that and wondering, you know, if what you gave was for naught, or, you know, if it was worth it given, you know, how this conflict is ending.
I'll say this to my fellow Americans, and I'm saying this as an American citizen, and I'm going to say this especially to privileged white men and women that live in this country that we have the blessing and privilege of living to, that all of a sudden want a Monday night quarterback and say this was inevitable or this was the right thing to do. That is the kind of talk that has veterans questioning whether it was worth it or not. But my message to my brother and sister veterans is it absolutely was worth it. We have not seen a 9/11 style attack on our shores since 9/11. And that is in no small part because of their sacrifice. It absolutely is directly correlated with the fact that we took the fight to them and we've kept the fight there for 20 plus years. So yes, your sacrifice mattered. And I want them to think about also the women that were allowed to become educated, college educated journalists, business owners that tasted freedom for 20 years, the little girls that were able to go to school for 20 plus years because of them. Do not listen to the privileged that got to grow up here and spent most of their time in a relatively wealthy, stable, and safe country, because what you did mattered, even if it only lasted for 20 plus years. And you don't know the seeds that you planted in these women and girls as they live under a Taliban regime. We will see what happens, but your sacrifice was definitely worth it.
Well, thank you so much, Representative Ortiz. I really appreciate your time today, and thanks for your thoughtful remarks on this.
I appreciate you doing a story on this.
To read Jesse's story about the Colorado veterans who served in Afghanistan, visit coloradosun.com. And before we go, here are a few stories that you should know about today. A new report by the conservation nonprofit American Forests found that trees are causing a shady divide in Denver. Wealthier white communities had a fuller tree canopy, while lower-income communities and those with more people of color had fewer trees and hotter neighborhood temperatures, which can lead to heat exhaustion, heat stroke, and other health issues. Planting more trees creates a more equitable living environment and improves public health, the report says. Governor Jared Polis has asked the state's Board of Health to require that certain state healthcare workers get vaccinated against the coronavirus. This includes those who work in nursing homes, long-term care facilities, hospitals, and surgical centers. The mandate is a shift from Polis's previously hands-off approach, where he left vaccination requirements up to employers and local governments. If the Board of Health agrees, a vaccination will become a condition of employment. Money spent to persuade Colorado's elected officials hit a record high in fiscal year 2021. According to data from the Secretary of State's office, nearly $44 million was spent by lobbyists to influence legislation, particularly healthcare and energy bills. That's up 32% from 2018, before Democrat Governor Jared Polis took office and Democrats took control of the state legislature and the party pursued an agenda often at odds with business interests. Two 157-year-old proclamations that led to the Sand Creek Massacre and death of 230 members of the Arapaho and Cheyenne tribes were officially rescinded by Governor Polis on Tuesday. Governor Polis called it an ongoing process to make amends with the sins of the past. For more information on all these stories, visit our website, www.coloradosun.com. Now, a quick message from our editor.
I'm Larry Rickman, editor and co-founder of the Colorado Sun. The Sun is a public benefit corporation, and we rely on the support of listeners and readers like you to produce the nonpartisan, in-depth news that Colorado needs and deserves. Please consider becoming a Sun member for just $5 a month. Learn more at coloradosun.com. Thanks.